This project is supported by funding from the Institute for Diversity and Civic Life, made possible by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation.
For some background, the Dallas Mexican American Historical League, DMAL, is a 501c3 organization dedicated to researching, collecting, and preserving the historical and cultural experiences of Mexican Americans in Dallas from the early 1900s to the present.
Through DMAL, the Emerging Historian Cohort is a contingent of young professionals assembled by DMAL lifetime member Rosemary Hinojosa in order to pass on the legacy of preserving our local history to the next generation of historians.
Nos puso la vida. Dejé todo, mis amigos, mi familia y mi ilusión. Y aunque allá he pasado los mejores años de mi vida, decir esto da tristeza, pero acá estamos mejor. Pero acá estamos mejor. Como extraño.
We welcome Dr. A.K. Sandoval Strauss. Today he will be speaking on the continued importance of his work, Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City, the compelling history of how Latino immigrants revitalized the nation's cities after decades of disinvestment and white flight. A.K. Sandoval Strauss is Director of Latino Studies and Associate Professor of History at Penn State University. He was born in New York City to immigrant parents, went uptown to college at Columbia University, and then on to University of Chicago for his PhD. He teaches courses in Latino studies, immigration history, and urban history, and his research has explored mobility, migration, and immigration. He is the author of Hotel in American History, Making Cities Global, the Transnational Turn in Urban History, and most recently, Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City, which won the Caroline Bancroft History Prize and was a finalist for the Victor Villaseñor Book Award. Thank you so much for your work in writing this book that focuses on the case of Oak Cliff and for speaking to us today. Welcome again, Dr. A.K. Sandoval Strauss.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your invitation to come speak and as a New Yorker and as a historian, I really appreciate the moment that you took to observe today's 20th anniversary of 9/11. It was one of the worst days in American history. And I hope that as we look forward, we think carefully about whether cynical people used the tragedy of that day to make us suspicious of outsiders, because as I think my presentation today will suggest, there's a lot of reason to be thankful to those who are new to our shores. Well, it is a pleasure to be speaking about Oak Cliff because it is there that I first began to do research on this project way back in 2009. Really, that was the place where the project first took form. And so I'm thankful to the community that launched the project. And in particular, I'd like to thank the Dallas Mexican American Historical League for connecting me with residents of Little Mexico before it was disrupted and of Oak Cliff in the early years of revitalization. I actually had the privilege of interviewing Jesse Tafalla at that time. He was a really important informant, helped me understand both the neighborhood, what had preceded it, and what went after. So it is really, truly an honor to be asked to give a talk in his memory. He was an extraordinary, extraordinary person. On a quiet street in Oak Cliff, in a modest yellow wood frame house, sits the headquarters of the Federación de Clubes Zacatecanos del Norte de Texas, the North Texas Federation of Zacatecan Clubs. The first thing you would notice stepping through the door is this display. Between the flags of Mexico and the United States is the official seal of the Mexican state of Zacatecas, based on the original coat of arms bestowed by Philip II of Spain in 1588. The display is the creation of the Federation's founder and president, Manuel Rodela Rodriguez. Rodela was born in 1942 and spent his childhood in Tepechitlan, a pueblo of just a few thousand people. When he was a boy, his family moved to Ciudad Juarez on the border. Rodela recalls, "I didn't want to go to Ciudad Juarez or anywhere else. My mother would say, "Let's go, my son, we're leaving." And I would answer, "No, you go ahead. I'd rather stay right here." In Juarez, Rodela and his brother formed a conjunto called Los Supremos, which a local newspaper called the most popular youth band on the border. He went on to study electronics at the city's Edison Institute. And a few years later, he married a Texas-born Mexicana. They moved to the United States in 1971. 10 years later, Gloria Rubio took a very different path to Oak Cliff. She had lived in El Sauce, a small river town named for its willow trees. And the area had long served as grazing land for livestock. And so it was very relatively quiet before the coming of the Salvadoran Civil War, before all of El Salvador was convulsed with killing. She fled El Sauce in 1981 when she was 19 years old. And indeed she left at the right time, because just a few years later, the town was the site of a mass killing by government forces. In Dallas, she held down two jobs to support herself. During the day, she recalled, "I kept house for a wealthy family. At night, I sold food from a small stand at a nightclub." She remembers that her offerings tracked the taste of the changing population. She prepared American hamburgers, Mexican tacos, and Salvadoran pupusas. Now, Rodela Rubio were two of dozens of Latin American migrants that my team interviewed between 2013 and 2016. And more importantly, they were just two people out of a remarkable migration of 25 million migrants, Latinos, Latinas, people from Latin America, who moved to or were born in US cities over about the past 50 years. And indeed, this migration is the subject of my book, Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City. I show that these 25 million migrants arrived just when they were needed most, because they arrived at a time when American cities were in deep distress. They were losing people, shedding jobs, facing fiscal emergencies and rising crime. And even beyond that, the sense that perhaps the era of the big American city had come and gone. If these migrantes had not come, a lot more American cities would look like those parts of Detroit, Michigan, or Gary, Indiana, or Youngstown, Ohio, who have become the sad poster children of urban decay, whose abandoned homes, shuttered factories, ghostly office buildings, and empty schools we know from books of ruins photography. In other words, they and immigrants from elsewhere in the world helped solve one of the biggest problems of the 20th century, the urban crisis. Now, this has been a national phenomenon. Immigrant-driven metropolitan revitalization has taken place across America. But to offer the really kind of detail we need to understand how this worked, my book focuses on two neighborhoods. The other one is Little Village in Chicago, but this afternoon, for obvious reasons, I'm going to focus on Oak Cliff. Now, as you doubtless already know, Oak Cliff was a rural area that became a town in 1890 and was annexed into Dallas in 1903. The thing was, it kind of disappointed its initial investors and settlers, because it grew very, very slowly for decades thereafter. It was considered a bit of a sort of town-making failure. But then in 1941, the United States Navy built a massive plant that produced aircraft and munitions and offered well-paid manufacturing jobs. So between 1940 and 1950, the local population swelled by more than 75% as thousands of families moved in. Around mid-century, you could see the resultant prosperity along Jefferson Boulevard, Oak Cliff's main shopping street. Exterior photos like these show a streetscape crowded with cars and lined with well-maintained storefronts. Inside, these shops displayed an abundance of consumer goods, and it's worth noting that Jefferson Boulevard was home to scores of small, independently owned local businesses. And indeed, it was in 1950 that Oak Cliff's population reached its 20th century peak. In this, it was much like Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, St. Louis. Almost every city in America was bigger than it ever had been before, and in many cases, bigger than it ever would be again in that year, 1950. Now, this is not to say that Oak Cliff was good for everyone. When journalist Grover Lewis wrote about leaving his community, the neighborhood where he had grown up in the 1940s and early 50s, his was not an exercise in nostalgia. On the contrary, he entitled the piece, "Farewell to Cracker Eden." Lewis recalled that, as he put it, the ethos of the place was absolute white supremacy, reinforced by old-time religion and male chauvinist prickism. And indeed, his opinion was well-founded, because when the civil rights era came, Oak Cliff was caught up in the city's numerous episodes of white resistance to integration. As Black families tried to escape Dallas's deliberately created and overcrowded ghettos by moving to previously white neighborhoods, they were met with repeated episodes of mob violence. And when it became clear that this would not stop residential integration, there was a wave of white departure to North Dallas and the suburbs. As a result, the neighborhood suffered three decades of net population loss. So when Grover Lewis revisited his childhood haunts in 1992, he wrote the following. He wrote, "The devastation was total. An entire neighborhood sunk in rot. The surviving houses were vine-choked, boarded up, literally atomizing in a ghastly mockery of the thriving community I recalled. I groped for terms to encompass the scope of the disaster: systemic collapse, municipal cancer, de facto apartheid, social time bomb, 1,000 points of dark." So when Lewis looked at Oak Cliff, he saw the urban crisis and focused on all the classic indicators of big city pathology. And indeed, it was easy to fit Oak Cliff into the story of the urban crisis, because things were terrible in many parts of big city America. So in 1950 to 1980, many cities lost as much as a third or more of their population. So for example, in those 30 years, Detroit lost 35% of its residents, Cleveland lost 37%. There's also a marked increase in crime. Nationwide, homicides doubled, property crimes tripled, assaults quadrupled. And indeed, this was a period when signs of distress were all around. People would take the subway or the train to work in the morning and see panoramic views of abandoned neighborhoods. Then they'd come home, turn on the evening news, and see story after story about violent crime in their city. So underlying this era, again, was this sort of widespread sense that maybe big cities were simply doomed. But urban America's luck was about to change, including in Oak Cliff. It turned out that Grover Lewis was seeing Oak Cliff in the darkness before dawn, because by that time, a huge influx of mostly Mexican and Salvadoran migrants had already set the neighborhood to growing again. In fact, it was growing even faster than Dallas as a whole. By 1990, Oak Cliff was home to 53,000 Latinos and also to 11,000 African-Americans. And thanks to them, the neighborhood had enjoyed its first significant population growth since the 1940s. By the year 2000, it was more than 3/4 Latino, 10% Black, and boasted more than 113,000 residents. That was 30% more than at its previous peak in 1950. All along Jefferson Boulevard, empty storefronts were being reoccupied. In 1970, the street had just one identifiable Latino business, but by the year 2000, it was dominated by bodegas, panaderias, taquerias, botanicas, fruterias, quinceañera and bridal shops, travel agencies, and money transfer outlets. Small, locally owned stores, in other words, had again become the backbone of the local economy. Residential real estate was recovering as well. I went tract by tract through the census data, looking at median home values and rents, and indeed, these had fallen in almost every Oak Cliff tract in the 1960s and the 1970s, even though in the rest of Dallas, they were actually still growing, they're still rising. But in the 1980s and 1990s, they rose in every single tract in Oak Cliff. And indeed, they rose so quickly, they outperformed the city as a whole. Meanwhile, crime decreased dramatically. Citywide, the homicide rate fell to barely more than a quarter of what it had been at its peak, from 500 homicides in 1991 to only 133 20 years later. And in Oak Cliff specifically, I was able to use the National Neighborhood Crime Study to show that the crime rate was significantly lower than in other comparable neighborhoods. So it was no wonder that by the mid-2000s, the city's leading newspaper was celebrating Oak Cliff as what it called the Latino downtown of Dallas. Now, stories of recovery like this were not limited to Oak Cliff. Most of urban America has seen a dramatic turnaround. Nationwide, crime fell to nearly 50-year lows, city neighborhoods were repopulated, and housing stock was refurbished. I mean, so much so that this became its own kind of a problem. After all, the biggest issue in many cities, at least before COVID, was no longer empty neighborhoods or abandoned properties, but instead it was a severe shortage of affordable housing, especially for working class families. Because with some admitted exceptions, right, I don't want to pretend that Detroit and Baltimore don't exist, but with very few exceptions, American cities have stopped losing population, and in most cases are growing again, mostly thanks to Latinos and other immigrants. So the question then becomes, how did they do it, right? How did these immigrants, people who earned limited incomes, were socially marginalized, politically demonized, and often undocumented, right? How did they manage to revitalize so much of urban America? Now, the most popular explanations have often centered on people with, frankly, a lot more money, right? The creative class, or yuppies and hipsters and globetrotting techno wizards. And indeed, this is a position most clearly associated with Richard Florida, with whose 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, really emphasizes the centrality of highly educated, highly trained white collar workers as the key to urban revitalization. But I should add that it wasn't just Richard Florida. Some of the same kinds of assumptions about how cities work also undergirded even much more critical, more Marxist approaches to urbanism, especially those associated with the hugely influential sociologist Saskia Sassen. And indeed, this is the sort of the Janus face of a narrative that is centered, whether from the center or the left, centered on the very well-to-do, really centered on a story of the most privileged of all urbanites. But on the contrary, in my book, I show that Latino population growth started earlier and really laid the foundations of for professional people to come back to the city later on. I'm happy to refer back to this during the Q&A. I have a few sort of statistics and graphs if people would like more detail on that. But right now, I want to focus not just on the quantities of people who moved to urban areas, but really the quality of the landscape that Latino immigrants created. Because really, that's the way that I phrase the question, right, is in the subtitle of my book. It's how Latino immigrants saved the American city. And this is sort of a question that can't just be answered quantitatively. The approach also has to be qualitative. So I'm going to focus on the special characteristics of three Latino landscapes. Number one, the landscape of business. Number two, the landscape of transportation. And number three, the landscape of home. And my sort of broad interpretive framework is that I'm going to suggest that each one of these landscapes was really a transplanted or adapted Latin American urban form. In other words, Latinos brought particular spatial practices and behaviors and adapted them for use in the United States. Let's begin with the business landscape. One of the major trends in the post-war decades was that a lot of stores were closing in city centers and reopening in suburban malls. Now, this wasn't sort of just bad for urban business people. It also depleted municipal tax bases and damaged street life. And Little Village and Oak Cliff during this urban crisis were cases in point with their empty storefronts and deserted sidewalks. Indeed, the urbanist William H. White once used the downtown of Dallas as a sort of example of just how deserted a formerly thriving city center could get. That was in his book, City. But when Latino immigrants arrived, they were able to revive local commerce because their ways of doing business fit perfectly with the existing architecture of places like Jefferson Boulevard. Now, these were streets lined with small storefronts. In the 1950s, they were very well suited to the scale of independent shops and offices. But with the rise of suburbia, retailers increasingly wanted to build stores on big urban lots so they can surround those stores with lots of parking. As a result, city neighborhoods with small 20 or 30 foot wide lots, they just weren't viable economically at the time. And that's why so many of the mom and pop stores that we were familiar with went out of business in the 1960s and 1970s, as the sort of local hardware store, sporting goods store, footwear store, pharmacy, et cetera, were being replaced by shopping centers and big box stores, especially out on the urban periphery. But things work differently in Latin America and in Latino America. South of the Rio Grande and throughout the rest of the hemisphere, the scale of retailing had remained small, with people running their own small businesses. And since supermarkets didn't really catch on until later, there were entire categories of store that had mostly disappeared from the United States, right? Things like independent butcher shops, independent bakeries, independent fruit stores, right? That were alive and well in Latin America as carnicerías and panaderías and fruterías. So as a result, in Oak Cliff and barrios like it, Latino small businesses managed to thrive in precisely the same years when English-speaking shopkeepers were going out of business. So again, how did they do it, right? They certainly worked very hard, but you know, so did small business people from many different backgrounds in the United States. They had particular advantages. The first of these was language. Stores run by migrantes enjoyed a very high customer loyalty because newcomers preferred to do business in Spanish and with people from their hometowns or at least home countries or home states. The second factor was simply competition or lack of competition. The big retailers were very slow to realize the potential of what they would today call the Latino market. And right, so their relentless cost cutting and predatory pricing that drove so many English language businesses out, right, was a lot less of a problem for Latino businesses because they simply didn't have to compete for the same customers. And that's how all those bodegas and taquerias and botanicas were able to revive commerce in places like Jefferson Boulevard, and indeed all across Latino America. Indeed, the Kaufman Index, an established measure of entrepreneurial activity, shows that in almost every single year from 1996 through 2019, Latinos were more likely than any other demographic group to open their own businesses. Now, one of the other factors underlying the success of Latino commerce is the second landscape I want to talk about, that is the transportation landscape. And this too was an adaptation of the Latin American urban norm into the space of US cities. When they came to Oak Cliff, Latinos often noticed the role of cars in their way of life. Teresa Ortiz Alvarado, who arrived in 1971 from a small town in Guanajuato, recalled that one of the reasons why Mexicanos liked Oak Cliff was that it was small and compact enough to get places on foot. He explained, as he put it, you could play in the streets, in the parks, not like North Dallas, where you never got out of your car. Similarly, longtime Oak Cliff resident Rosario Gaitan observed, walking, I mean, it's a culture thing to me. Around here, the Mexicanos, they'll walk to the bank, they'll walk down the street, but growing up, Anglos mostly didn't. And indeed, this isn't just sort of anecdotal. If you look closely at the census data, it's easy to demonstrate that Latino households in Oak Cliff had far fewer cars per person than Anglo households, either in Oak Cliff or across Dallas. And indeed, this is probably what we should expect considering the history of automobiles in Latin America. The fact is that very few people owned them until relatively recently. I think two statistics from Mexico will ably illustrate this. In 1960, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development found that in Mexico, there were 22 motor vehicles for every 1,000 people. In the United States at that time, the figure was 18 times higher. It was 411 vehicles per 100 people, per 1,000 people. And I should add that even 50 years later, when they reran those figures in 2010, the United States figure was still five times higher. There were 165 automobiles per 1,000 people in Mexico, 812 per 1,000 in the United States. I should also add that automobile ownership was especially rare in rural Mexico, where most of the early migrants to Oak Cliff came from. So for example, in the village of Tzintzuntzan, Michoacán, in 1945, none of the 246 inhabitants owned a car or truck. In 1960, only one of 320 residents did. And even by 1970, only 11 people out of 360 owned any kind of car. Now, given that historians and urbanists agree that the automobile has had unparalleled influence over how cities work, what they look like, the advent of sprawl, given that fact, it should come as no surprise that the sort of pedestrian culture of Latino immigrants could have a major development a major influence on the development of US cities. The third landscape I want to talk about is the landscape of home. Some years ago, a really smart cultural geographer named Daniel Arreola identified a particular kind of house that was common in Mexican-American neighborhoods. It was a dwelling that included a freestanding house with fencing along the front of the property, visible here at right. Now, he interpreted it as a combination of the classic detached Anglo house, the one in the middle in this diagram, and the Mexican courtyard home, the one on the left. Shortly thereafter, urban planner James Rojas elaborated on this idea of the Mexican-American homescape. He emphasized that the residential space of this kind of home did not end at the front of the house. Rather, it extended family life onto the porch and into the front yard, right up to a chain link or wrought iron fence at the property line. Rojas also pointed out that this front area was often in frequent use throughout the day. Family and friends would sit on the porch or the stairs, and from there they could supervise small children who played safely inside the fence line. Indeed, in the years since, this front yard space has even garnered its own Spanglish term. It's called La Yarda, right? You can see it all over Latino America and hear it referred to all the time. Here's some examples from the Oak Cliff Barrio in Chicago. I should say that it's not just repeated lot after lot, but block after block. You sort of walk down the street, you'll see just the same general occurrence of fencing with kids' play areas in front and lots of people watching from the stairs or the window. And I think this really has major implications for how cities work. I spoke earlier about how crime dropped in Oak Cliff as Latino immigrants moved in. Well, that effect is not limited to South Dallas or to Dallas or even to Chicago or any one city. On the contrary, it's an effect that has been observed in almost every Latino barrio in which it's been measured. Numerous scholars have shown that immigrant Latino neighborhoods, and I should add all immigrant neighborhoods, are not just safer for the immigrants who live there, but also everybody else who lives there. Moreover, the neighborhoods that border those immigrant neighborhoods, even if they don't have many immigrants in them, those neighborhoods are noticeably, statistically, significantly safer as well. The key here is that while sociologists have sort of observed this phenomenon beyond the shadow of a doubt, they don't really have a theory for why crime is lower in Latino neighborhoods. And I think that the built environment is a key point of articulation. So in other words, what I'm trying to suggest is that Latino landscapes are essential here because both the outdoor domesticity of La Yarda and the bustling street traffic around Latino businesses are partially responsible for the low crime rate in Latino neighborhoods, right? That's because they serve as what the renowned urbanist, right? One of the most famous scholars ever to study cities, what Jane Jacobs called eyes upon the street. Right? She said that public order is not simply kept by the presence or absence of the police. Equally important are people who are sitting on stoops, looking out of windows, sweeping the sidewalks in front of their stores, and in the process, keeping an eye on the neighborhood and everybody who passes through it. I think it's important to note here that it's not just me, it is not just the migrantes themselves who have understood their contribution to cities. Urban political and business leaders have also clearly seen the importance of migrants in sustaining their populations and workforces. Indeed, they have organized to attract newcomers. One of the things that was especially surprising about the census returns from 2010 was that they showed that some cities had continued to lose population, even while many other cities had gained it. So Detroit was the classic case in point. It's a city that just between 2000 and 2010 lost 25% more of its population. I was saying earlier that Detroit, like many cities, had lost one third of its population over the course of 30 years. But here was a period of just 10 years where it lost another 25% of its population. And so beginning with Detroit, a number of cities actually organized to try to attract immigrants in hopes of forestalling and reversing their urban decline. So Global Detroit was the first of these groups. It was sort of a development initiative that united political leaders, business leaders, and community organizations. And indeed, their mission statement said outright the following, quote, "Immigration has proven by far to be the best American strategy to combat population loss." I should say that a few years later, they joined with municipal officials from across the nation's industrial heartland to establish what became known as the Welcoming Economies Global Network. It's now a group called Welcoming America, and its motto is Leading Rust Belt Immigrant Innovation. Right? It's got, I think, 26 affiliates in cities across the region. And so you can see that those who are closest to the, you know, the well-being or decline of cities, those who have primary responsible for municipal welfare, have really taken to the idea of sitting up and taking notice of the essential role of immigration in restoring their communities to economic viability. I should say, though, that these urban leaders were not alone in seeing the benefit of immigration to cities. Urban professionals also increasingly looked to Latino urban spaces. They sought out neighborhoods with, quote, character and authenticity. In numerous places, urban professionals paid barrios their highest compliment by gentrifying them, right? And there are many examples of this. There's San Francisco's Mission District, there's Los Angeles's Boyle Heights, there's New York City's Washington Heights. And indeed, speaking of Washington Heights, right, it was indicative that Lin-Manuel Miranda and Kiara Hudes wrote a scene into their musical, which is now, you know, a Hollywood movie, in which the main character, bodega owner Usnavi de la Vega, he asks the following. He says, in 5 years, when this whole city's rich folks and hipsters, who's gonna miss this raggedy little business? And indeed, right, this was certainly the case in actual barrios. I offer the example, tragically, of Casas Blan on Chicago's West Side, right? This was a community center for decades. It was covered with old murals that celebrated some of the heroes of Latino and of Latin American history. And what happened was that it was bought by some investment capitalists, basically. And despite the fact that these were irreplaceable, beautiful murals that were among the most best loved features of the entire community, one day they just sent painters in and painted them over completely. It's a real sort of act of vandalism against the heritage of the neighborhood. A few years ago, an immigrant named Jose Luis Arroyo described an incident that summed up key aspects of recent US metropolitan history. He told the following story. He says, this young Anglo guy comes along and he says, hola, ¿cómo estás? He was speaking Spanish and everything. Fine, thanks, I tell him. What can I do for you? He says, well, this was my father's house and I want to buy it. I tell him, but it's not for sale. He says, but I like it here. I was born in this neighborhood. And so I ask him, so why did you leave? He says, I don't know why my father moved out. He just moved out. But Arroyo says, as Latinos, we understand, right? These Americans left because they thought we were going to destroy their neighborhood. These young people's parents got scared and they moved away and they took their children with them. And these children grew up and became professionals and they came back to visit the barrio and now they want to move back. By way of conclusion, let's remember that despite recent years of intensely anti-immigrant policy, the United States is still home to 45 million immigrants, right? That is the largest population of foreign-born people in the entire world. I should also add that the second place country, Germany, has only 10 million foreign-born people. So we're more than four times the size of immigrant population than our nearest competitor. And this is essential because we, as a nation, depend on them. As a rising number of commentators have noted, America's birth rate has fallen to a rate far too low to maintain our economy, our institutions, right? Whether it be our workforce, whether it be enough people to pay into Social Security, whether it be recruits for the military. And I should say that this is not just an American problem. It's also true of virtually every advanced industrial and post-industrial nation in the world, right? You see exactly the same effect in Germany, in Italy, in Japan, in Russia. And indeed, we have the good fortune of attracting lots of immigrants from all around the world because really immigrants are the solution to this new national crisis, right? They are the only ones keeping us out of a demographic death spiral that threatens the sort of economic viability of the entire country. Thanks to them, our population continues the same very slow but essential growth, right? If you look at, you know, despite the people running around with their hair on fire calling immigration a threat, if you look at the last 50 years of data, The population of the United States has been growing at less than 1% a year for about half a century. And about the rate is about the same now. So the future of America has arrived, right? It's living at the corner of E Pluribus Unum and Aquí Estamos y No Nos Vamos. We can see this in the faces of the nation's school children, our neighbors, our coworkers and caretakers, our baseball players. We can taste it in the food on our plates, which would be empty if not for the hands that picked the produce, processed the meat and poultry, and worked unseen in restaurant kitchens. And we can hear it in the words of a people who, despite so many years of being dispossessed, overworked and underpaid, and falsely accused, have been among the most optimistic of all Americans. So it now falls to us to make sure that we return to our best traditions of welcoming immigrants, both because it is right, and because without immigrants and their families, and frankly, a lot more immigrants and their families, there really is no viable future for this place we call America. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and begin the questions.
Sure.
So a question is, have you seen Hentification on Netflix, and what are your thoughts on the series?
It's a terrific, terrific thing. I believe America Ferrera produced that. And it's a really smart show because it points out a couple of things, right? Number one, it points out that gentrification is a very real thing. But it also points out that while we think, so most people imagine gentrification as white people moving into black and brown people's neighborhoods, and that is often the case, right? That it can also take other forms, that it's all about, you know, not just racial difference, but unmistakably economic difference. And that, you know, there are problems even when it's people coming back to El Barrio. And the fact is, when people with money move into a neighborhood, unless specific measures are taken, unless specific municipal codes are updated, it is almost certain that they will force people out. And I should also add, right, that it creates even a division within the community of people who already live in the barrio, because those who are property owners, right, they may have bought a property for $50,000 or $60,000 in the 1970s or 1980s, and somebody is saying, I'll give you $3.5 million for it, right? It's not that they're bad people. It's just that it's very hard when somebody says, I'll write you a check for $3.5 million right now. Unless you're very, very rich, that's something that's hard to say no to. So property owners can benefit from gentrification. On the other hand, renters, right? Those are the people who suffer the most. So often, you know, one of the things that can stand in the way of united community action to forestall gentrification is that divide between property owners and renters.
Thank you for speaking to that. I think sometimes either party can get caught up in their own circumstances and not consider the other. And whenever a pebble is thrown into that pond or lake, you know, the ripples come out and affect everybody. So exactly. Thank you for talking about that. So also, I heard you mention like aquí estamos y no nos vamos. And I thought that was just interesting because I have a print here. It's a little house. I don't know if you can see it, but Angela Faz, who's an artist here from West Dallas and Oak Cliff, she made those prints, and it says exactly that in one of her other images as well. But something that I was wondering if you ever came upon in your research was the extra layer of hardship for elderly people who are Spanish speaking whenever this comes into a community. I've had friends who have had grandparents have people come up to their doorstep with documentation and say, sign this, I'm from the city. Have you heard things like that or come upon that?
Well, I mean, what I can say is that there was a lot of shady operating in another time and place in Dallas, precisely against those groups of people, right? When the city began to drive highways through Little Mexico, the previous sort of main Mexican-American and Mexican neighborhood, There were a lot of people committing what is called affinity fraud, right? Affinity fraud is like fraud, but people take advantage of their some sort of similarity they have with the people that they're trying to defraud. So, right, if you look back into the archives, you can find old, Mexicanos, Chicanos, Mexican Americans in Little Mexico saying that, there'd be these Hispanic real estate agents, and they'd be the ones trying to scare us out of our houses, right? They'd be the ones trying to take whatever shady measure they could to try to get us out. And often there was kind of, you're required to leave, because Latinos were not very politically organized. And let me pause for a moment here and say, it was Jesse Tafalla specifically who pointed this out. He said back in the 70s and 80s, Latinos were not very well organized at all because Dallas had an at-large system of choosing city council members. So as a result, right, even though you had a huge Mexican-American presence, because votes were done citywide, virtually the entire city council was white Anglo. So they didn't really have anywhere to go. They had so little representation, as he said, they just wanted to keep us in the barrio and ignore us. So that kind of affinity fraud that can be, practiced by every nationality, every ethnicity, was unmistakably, part of the scene of trying to drive people out. So, I think we should tell, los viejos y las viejas, like, don't ever sign anything, don't ever talk to anybody unless there's somebody you trust, right there with you.
Yes, exactly. I have another question here. Thank you, Dr. Sandoval Strauss, for the presentation. How has immigration policy, like the 1965 and 1986 immigration reform laws, helped cities? And what do you think policymakers can do now to help prosperity in places like Oak Cliff without displacement?
All right, well, let's start with 1965 and 1986, right? Remember that 1965 is often misunderstood, right? In 1965, the Hart-Celler Act put an end to decades of racist exclusion quotas that kept anybody from anywhere in the world, really with the exception of Northwestern Europe, from legally immigrating to the United States. So, the elimination of those quotas in 1965 was a really very important thing. However, there was one flaw that was introduced into the legislation by Southern segregationists in Congress. The original draft of the 1965 law that Lyndon Johnson and his allies in Congress, the ones that they presented, ended all of the quotas, but also kept in place a longstanding exemption to those quotas from anyone from within the Americas. So in the same years that they were barring the door to Italians, to Central European Jews, to Greeks, to people from Poland, and definitely to people from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, right? In those same years, because agricultural production in this country was so fundamentally dependent upon Mexican labor, they exempted Mexicanos and people from all across the hemisphere from those restrictions. They intended to keep those exemptions in place, but essentially segregationists who were afraid that America would become more diverse blackmailed Johnson and said, we'll tie this up in committee forever. You have to impose some of these quotas on the Americas as well. And that suddenly took what had been a longstanding movement of people back and forth across the US-Mexico border and suddenly made it illegal. In other words, that law created an illegal immigration problem in the same way that if you set the highway speed limit to 45, you'd suddenly make criminals out of everybody who's just driving the same speed they had been before. Now, by the 1980s, there was some realization of what had gone wrong. So the 1986 La IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, had as one of its provisions a legalization that was taken advantage of by about 3 million people, mostly undocumented folks from Mexico. And you could see that as soon as those 3 million people suddenly got their legal status, never had to worry about the knock on the door and they take you away, right? they began to invest in their neighborhood. You can see this, you know, cliff. So for example, Gloria Rubio mentioned that right after La Amnistia, you saw people buying their houses, you saw people, you know, opening second businesses, third businesses, and really taking, you know, actions that at the time when they could again be suddenly grabbed and deported at any time, you can't really make long-term investments under those circumstances. But those 3 million, right, distributed all across America, because they now had legal status, they really dramatically improved businesses. You know, I have a lot of statistical information on Oak Cliff, on Little Village in Chicago. That worked really nationwide. It has been sort of demonstrated in study after study that if there is a problem with underpaid, undocumented people, the solution to that problem is to give them some sort of legal status so they can get the wages that really they are deserved. So for people who say, oh, these undocumented people, usually they call them something else, are driving down wages, I'll say the evidence for that is fairly shady, but you know what? We can be sure they're not. And this comes into the third question of what kind of measures can we take to improve the fortunes of urban America? And I should add, this is a problem that is now, you know, in rural America as well. There are plenty of rural towns that have suffered the same kind of depopulation over the past 10, 20 years as urban America was in the decades before that. They're the ones now most in need of more immigrants. So if we both gave legal status to undocumented people and invited in a lot more immigrants, I mean, I think what you're gonna see, you know, as has been talked about a lot of the news, more than 100,000 people were airlifted out of Afghanistan before the transfer of power, unfortunately, to the Taliban. You're going to see cities and towns lining up saying, we'd love to see some of these folks resettled in our city because they desperately want to be here. They desperately want to work hard. And just like past generations of immigrants and refugees, these people will be terrific Americans just given half a chance.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Alec Bass. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, Alex. In the instance of Bishop Arts, do you think there are only being 3/4 landlords that are not Latinos and have not lived in Oak Cliff affects how they focus on urban development instead of preservation of the community and the people already there?
Yes, definitely, right? I mean, let's also recognize that I was saying before that you know, the series Kentification illustrates that this can be a problem even when the newcomers are also Latino. But when they're not, they often, you know, they want to maximize their profits. And so they open businesses of a kind that don't really serve the local community. So I won't really specify some of them, but let's say that some of the newer businesses in Bishop Arts, nobody working class, nobody Latino is going to be like, yes, I want to pay such and such a amount of money for, again, I won't get specific about what they're selling, but there are some examples of businesses that manage to serve everybody, right? So Charco Broilers on Jefferson, I had a great interview, with Mr. Cordova. He says, you know, I'm a white good old boy. I have the name Cordova, but he said, our business was a family business since the 1960s. It was about to go out of business in the 1990s because so many folks were leaving Oak Cliff. And he said, it was the Mexican crowd that saved us, right? We changed up a little bit of what we were serving. We, you know, put a little more, you know, cilantro and jalapenos in, and learned to make the foods that they wanted to. And that became a successful business that can serve both the local community, right, and people who come in for just a look or even new residents. So I think the trick has got to be figuring out, you know, through ongoing collaboration with developers to say, you know, what you don't want to do is destroy what makes this neighborhood special. What you don't want to do is like kill the goose that laid the golden egg, because if you just, you know, Angloify and whiten every business here, it's not going to be very interesting. So they need to sort of step back and do what, again, some of the, and again, I'm not going to promote any particular restaurants, but there are some businesses that have very successfully figured out how to serve both clienteles and sometimes at a price point that is accessible for a lot of people. great question. Thank you for asking it.
Yeah, thank you for your answer. Could you speak to why you picked Oak Cliff for your comparative analysis? And this is a question from Selena Garcia.
Sure, absolutely. Now, I think Dallas and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex are tragically understudied cities because they're really interesting and they're very representative of some of the major trends in American urbanism, right? You want to talk about a city that has a similar morphology to places like Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Atlanta, Dallas does precisely that. So, you know, those who want to study the Sun Belt, you know, definitely want to be looking at Dallas. And indeed, there's a terrific collection called Sun Belt Rising, edited by Michelle Nickerson and Darren Dochuk, when Dr. Nickerson was teaching at UT Dallas. And so she really saw the importance of the local community. Now, as far as my choosing it, so I went to graduate school in Chicago, right? And there I had a front row seat for the sort of Latinization of large parts of the city, right? So people often thought of Chicago as a city of white people and black people. But the fact was that if you just get on the bus heading west from the university, there's a big and very famous African-American neighborhood. But if you stay on that bus for about 20 minutes, you end up in Oak Lawn, right? Which is a big Mexican neighborhood with, again, panaderias and carnicerias and taquerias that I used to go to with friends of mine for lunch all the time. And I understood that that was sort of a big transformation in Chicago, but because there are at least two different kinds of urbanism, a lot of people don't like to use the term Rust Belt, but let's call it the Industrial Belt story of urban America is very different from the Sun Belt story of urban America. So I needed a Sun Belt city to study. Thankfully, my wife had a fellowship at SMU in 2009 and 2010. And I came along because we had two 18-month-old kids at the time and we're not gonna live separate from each other. And I went into SMU and I asked, so what's the sort of major Mexican or Latino neighborhood in the city? And Ruth Ann Elmore, who still works there, said, oh yeah, Oak Cliff, head right down there. And I jumped in our car and I got off the highway and sort of approached from the south and there was like 12 blocks of Mexico. I thought, this is the perfect example. Now, of course, the Metroplex is one of the 10 biggest metropolitan areas in the United States. So I can unapologetically say, this is the perfect example, of it's one big neighborhood in one very big city. But again, if you look at the 25 most populous cities in America, of those, two are majority Latino, right? Both of those are in Texas. A third is almost, LA is almost. I think eight of them are one third or more Latino, and 13 of those 25 biggest are one quarter or more Latino, right? So again, Dallas is just one example of a much broader phenomenon. It just sort of provided an especially dramatic and thriving example.
Wonderful. I think this will be our last question. It's from Frank Bravo, one of our DeMol board members. Do you see the kind of leadership within our community to keep us relevant in the future?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, again, I know that Rafael Anchia has been a really important advocate, locally, and he really understands some of the issues that face Oak Cliff. And I should say, Dallas has undergone a bit of a transformation over the past 20 years, such that the kind of point of view of its residents and of its governance is a lot more representative of what Texas looks like, right? So in the Texas state legislature, there's been a lot of gerrymandering and adjustment precisely to prevent Black and brown people from having representation. You don't see that nearly as much as the municipal level. So, if you look at Dallas itself, it has a much more the city council in Dallas looks a lot more like the population of Dallas. I hope that extends more broadly into the state, because it's already a majority-minority state, and it cannot prosper without the kind of leadership that says, you know, there's a reason why cities were full of immigrants. There's a reason why a small number of cities produces 70% of the GDP of this entire country. And that's because the combination of highly educated people, native-born immigrant, and working-class people really create sort of the kind of urban dynamism, again, that now drives our economy. So if at one time people looked at big cities and said, you know, that's just not where the economy is going to be, today they're saying big cities are just the dynamos that drive us nationally. So the kinds of more diverse governance that is in effect in Dallas and Chicago and other big cities, that really has to be the kind of governance that we look at nationally in the future.
Wonderful. I'll go ahead and share my screen with our closing message. So that is the time that we have scheduled together today. I just wanted to share how our current organization president, Albert Valtierra, he spoke about how you two connected whenever you were doing your research, and you told him that Damal tells history from the bottom up. And I think that's something that had a really large impact on our board. Hopefully the next time that we get to collaborate with you, it'll be better circumstances regarding COVID, and we'll get to meet in person. And so that way we can also get our copies signed by the author. Which reminds me, please support his work by adding it to your own book collection. For more information about the work that Damal is doing, please follow and like us on social media at Damal Official, and become a member of the organization, choosing the different committees that most interest you. Thank you, everyone, for spending your time with us. Thank you again, Dr. A.K. Sandoval Strauss. Blessings and abundance. Bye-bye.
Igual. Gracias.
Bien sabido. Que no es fácil ser amigo de la ruina.